I've changed the order I've decided to do things, so apologies for that. So it just seemed to make more sense when I came to really writing out the details. So today we're going to do T-structures and tilting and so on. So I apologise for those of you who know nothing about drive categories, and I promised that you would understand this anyway. But maybe it won't be so bad. And it's going to start with some kind of... It's going to be a little bit kind of dry and technical to start with, but then the second half of the talk will be all examples, so hopefully it will become more interesting. And really, this business about T-structures is really kind of the most abstract and the most tricky part of the whole story of stability conditions. Or, you know, it's the hardest thing to digest, I think. I mean, because algebraic geometers are very used to the idea of varying... stable vector bundles, for example, and varying the polarization and seeing stability changing. That's not a really big new idea for them. But this T-structures thing is really where the actual homological algebra is going, and that's the thing that's maybe less familiar to the algebraic geometer on the street. So I just wanted to remind you of this picture, because this is kind of really a helpful thing to bear in mind during this. So remember we had... So this was supposed to be a picture of the derived category of P1. And this bit here was just the category of coherent sheaves on P1. And the derived category was like some film strip, because we had... we could shift... So these were kind of sheaves considered in degree zero, and we could just shift them to the right and we get a whole new copy of these things. And we said... So here, for instance, was the line model O and O1...
And you sort of said that we need to consider maps of the sort of the line bundle to a point.
Right.
Do you mean that because they don't, and still we can have all the information in the drive category, or just because they're not?
This is just a way of drawing a picture. I mean, those maps are there, of course, but if we drew all the maps that exist, we would have maps here and we would have maps going everywhere. So my rule was to say that I'm only drawing maps which don't factor via other maps. So I'm not drawing a map from O minus 1 to O1, because they all factor like this.
Yeah.
And similarly, actually, any map that goes to a point factors via the next one along.
Right.
So in some sense, I mean, you know, this is an infinite picture, but if I'm going to be consistent about things, I shouldn't draw any maps from here to here.
But some implicit in your picture is that this picture kind of limits on the left to this.
Oh,
so
yeah.
So it sort of is in the picture, because it has this limit.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean,
not every map is a composition of arrows you're showing.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, that's a good point. Yeah. I mean, I don't like to take this picture too seriously. I mean, it's just some kind of picture to bear in mind when you think of this category. I mean, obviously, really, the category is just all the objects and all the maps between them, and still, that will have some big chunk here and some big chunk here, and so on. And if you tried to do this for any other variety, you would just fail. I mean, there's just far too many objects. You would just, you know, it would be impossible to do it. Okay, but one thing that was important. Well, in this case, we had this special property because we were on a curve. Everything was a direct sum of pieces in this and pieces in this. So I kind of told you that generally, an object you should think of as being glued together by, objects concentrated in one degree, but then you glue those things together. But on a curve, it's not the glue goes away. And we're in an even more special situation because. On P1, all vector bundles are sums of line bundles. So you know, there are all these special things going on. But now I want to sort of actually tell you what happens in general. So this is really, I mean, this is what a T-structure is. So let's take D to be the derived category of some Abelian category. I mean, well, maybe I should emphasize this is the bounded one. So we discussed lots of properties of this last time. We said, you know, there were these distinguished triangles. The objects of this thing are complexes of objects of A, and the maps between them, well, they're a little bit more tricky, but at least they form some just kind of Abelian group. The fact that you can also consider categories which satisfy those properties, you know, have these distinguished triangles and so on. They're called triangulated categories. But this one is a special one. It's a derived category, and it means it's got some extra structure. And what this structure is these things called truncation functors. So let me just explain these, because they're pretty easy. So it's basically just that if you have a complex, you can truncate it. So and then I'm going to take the kernel of DI. Okay, so maybe it would be better if I wrote this complex out. All right, so here's the, right, so a complex is just a bunch of objects and maps between them, which satisfy the composition of any two of them is zero. So I just truncate like this. And the reason this is a sensible thing to do is that if you think about taking the cohomology of this guy, this is the same as the cohomology of the thing you started with, except truncated. So if I did it right. Right, because I mean, the cohomology along here is obviously the same because we haven't done anything. But obviously up here it's zero. And if I think about the cohomology here, I take the kernel of this map, which is just exactly this, and divide by the image. And what you can easily show is that these actually, I mean, if you take the mapping cones of maps between these, you get a system of triangles. So these fit into distinguished triangles. Looking like this. So, I mean, there are obvious canonical maps like this. You know, you're just truncating further back. And you can think about what the cone is on one of these guys. So you can form... So one of the axioms of the triangulated category tells you can always form a cone. But anyway, in this case, we just take the mapping cone. And then if you think about the long exact sequence in cohomology, you will see that this is the identity in cohomology, apart from in one place. And so it's pretty easy to see that what goes on here is that you just exactly have the ith cohomology put in the right place. Okay, so that's something that's pretty easy to check. And also, since we're bounded, since in the bounded case, which we're always in, this is quasi-isomorphic to zero if I is far enough to the left, and it's the whole of E if I is far enough to the right. Kind of obviously. I mean, this complex is just some bounded thing. It's not going to... these truncations are not going to do anything if you go far enough to the left or the right. And so what you should think of this is you should think of this as exactly like a filtration. Okay, so I said that triangles are like short exact sequences. So what this is saying is that every object has a canonical filtration whose factors are these cohomology pieces. Okay. So this is exactly what we were seeing over here, except in this case, all these things, all these maps here, were zero. So that this whole, you know, in other words, these think of them as like short exact sequences. These all split, so that the thing was actually a direct sum. But in general, they don't split. You just get some filtration into these pieces. Okay. Right, so now we can give the abstract definition of a T structure. And actually, I'll give you the definition of the heart of a T structure instead. So you could just call this a heart, but really what it means is a heart of a bounded T structure. So at this point, we're just in some triangulated category. D is a full subcategory A in D, such that the following two properties are satisfied. So one, there exist filtrations. So for all E in D, there exist numbers and a filtration, triangles, if you like. So what, how shall I write this? Zero. I mean, it's exactly axiomatizing what we just said, where Fi is in this thing shifted by Ki. So all I've done is I've taken this big filtration and I've thought to myself, well, quite a lot of these things could be zero, so I should just remember the ones that are not zero. So I will get some actually descending sequence of numbers. Did I do this wrong? Yeah, actually be like that. No, I didn't like that. Let's just have a little think. It's one of those impossible things, trying to work out whether something's increasing or decreasing at the blackboard. Right, so these numbers are getting smaller, so these numbers are getting bigger as we go that way. So that looks fine here. Okay, so only finitely many of these things are non-zero, so we just group them up like that. And the other condition is that if we take two objects, Hom D, A1, A2, why don't we stick the K here, equals naught if K is less than or equal to zero. K is less than zero. Okay, so I don't expect you to jump with joy at this definition, but it's kind of the heart of the whole story, really, is this definition. And I hope I at least kind of motivated this in some way, that whenever you have a complex in the derived category, you can indeed exactly come up with such a filtration. And this last property is just the fact that negative X groups are zero. Because I told you that if you take two objects in the abelian category, then these higher HOMs are the X groups. So the examples would be A in DBA. That's an example. And one thing I didn't say is that it's a good exercise, not a particularly easy one. But actually, part of this, as a consequence of this definition, tells you that A is actually abelian. Okay, so you get that for free. Okay, so one example would be this. That's somehow what I tried to motivate. And another example would be that if you have some equivalent, just kind of the obvious thing, if you have some equivalence phi, then phi inverse of B is some, you can think of this as this is a heart. I mean, obviously, this category is equivalent to B. Okay, so this is exactly what I'm, somehow the point of this. Rather than thinking about derived equivalences, I can just think about whenever I have a derived equivalence, that what that means is I have a kind of slightly surprising heart sitting inside my derived category. Okay. So again, in the derived category, there are these canonical system of filtrations of every object. But that's only the case if you know that if you're thinking of your category as the derived category of something. But that thing could perfectly well be the derived category of something else, and then there will be a whole different bunch of filtrations. Okay.
This filtration is unique with the properties.
Yeah, exactly. So there will be lots of these situations. Will come up, maybe an easier one to understand will come up in a minute, but these two definitions, these two properties go very well together, because you can actually see, it'll be easier in the next case, that this implies that this filtration must be unique. So you just ask for existence here, but this one will ensure that it's actually unique. Okay, so let's do that now. So there's a kind of a... So now I just want to introduce one more kind of piece of abstraction. I want to talk about this operation called tilting. And again, in this picture, we saw this, because what we said was that if we sort of drew our film strip in a different place, then, you know, obviously you can just kind of move the window of your film strip along, and still you have a nice kind of film strip picture. And we saw that this is actually isomorphic to representations of this quiver. So now, of course, it looks something like this. And another way of thinking of what we did there is we took this category, we chopped a bit off the front, and we stuck it on the back, and called that our new abelian category. So that's the thing I just want to explain now. It's a very trivial operation, but it has some pretty... I mean, I will then show some examples of this operation. So I need to tell you, what does it mean to sort of... I said cut a piece off the back, you know, take a piece off the front of the category. So what does that mean? So let's suppose that A is an abelian category now. So a torsion pair. So these are T and F is a pair of full subcategories. With the following properties, which you should see is completely analogous, such that A, you have filtrations, so for all E in A exists a short exact sequence with T in curly T and F in curly F, and B, HOM T, F equals 0. So now you'll probably be very happy with the statement that this ensures that this short exact sequence is unique. I mean, that's a kind of easy exercise. Imagine you have some different short exact sequence like this, and you'll, you know, just play around with the maps, and you'll see that this is unique. Okay, now, so now this kind of... I suppose I could give an example. I mean, to algebraic geometers, the obvious thing to do is take torsion sheaves and torsion-free sheaves on a variety, and we're kind of... we're very familiar with the idea that every sheaf has a torsion subsheaf, a unique torsion subsheaf, and its quotient is a torsion-free guy. And there are no maps from torsion to torsion-free things. But there are obviously millions and millions of examples of torsion pairs. It wouldn't be hard to come up with some more. And then there's a lemma, which is this is tilting. It's very important. It's only a lemma. But, so it's this, that if you have some D triangulated and A in D a heart, and furthermore you have some torsion pair in A, then you can just move everything along. You can define a new abelian, a new heart, so a new T structure, if you like. And it's, I mean, you can write it in various ways, but basically it's just the thing you get by... it's generated by these. Let me draw a picture in a minute. Here's a new heart. So let me just draw the picture. So here's if there's A shifted by minus 1, A shifted by plus 1, But now we've actually split, let's do a different colour. So now we've actually split this into two pieces. Here's T, and, well, here's T, and here's F, and I guess, I mean, here's F shifted by 1, and here's T shifted by 1, minus 1. And then it's up to you, really, what we choose, but we're going to choose our new abelian categories to be, so what did I do? T and F shifted by 1, yeah, so we're choosing it to be this. Okay, and then this bit is F shifted by minus 1, so. Okay, so the proof of this lemma should now be kind of obvious. We're just saying that we have filtrations of every object into these pieces, but now we can refine the filtrations because each of these pieces has a kind of filtration, a two-step filtration into T and F, and then we just stick the filtrations back together in a different order. Well, not in a different order, but we draw the lines in a different place. Okay. And so every object has a filtration in terms of this new thing. So that operation is called tilting. A sharp is the tilt. And it's sort of a really fundamental, you know, just, I mean, as you can see, everything I've been doing here is sort of just abstract nonsense. This is just a, you know, a kind of pretty fundamental operation that's out there. And so one thing we could say is that, I mean, we have one example to mind it already. So, we have a torsion pair in coherent sheaves on P1, which is just, I mean, T consists of, what does T consist of? Well, maybe it's easier to say, well, yeah, let's say what. T is all those coherent sheaves on P1. What am I going to say? So let's just say we've drawn the line here. So basically I would want that, yeah, just all, yeah, all indecomposable factors have positive degree. So in other words, I'm allowing myself to take O of 1, O of 2, and so on all the points. And F would then be those sheaves on P1, so all factors degree less than or equal to 0. I guess we should say all non-zero factors. Okay, and then if we take this to be the torsion pair, then the tilted thing will actually be isomorphic to representations of this quiver. And the tilted thing is exactly taking this off the front and putting it on the back. Okay. I mean, I had this little discussion with Dan the other morning. I mean, how many ways could we think about tilting this? I mean, you know, where could we draw the line? Well, I mean, the thing you notice is there's a symmetry here, which is tensoring by O of 1. That's a symmetry of the whole derived category. You know, you can tensor by a line bundle, everything's preserved. So in that sense, there's no real choice where to draw this line in amongst these guys, because we can just tensor the whole thing by O of 1 or O of 2, and that will move the line along. So we'll get the same answer. Wherever we draw this line in this piece, we'll always get representations of that quiver. Slightly more peculiarly, we could, and this is actually true, you could choose an arbitrary set of points on P1, and you could say that your torsion theory consists of all sheaves supported on those points, right? And I didn't say this has to be, you know, it could have been any set of points, you know, your 7 favourite points on P1. So that will immediately show you that the set of T structures is absolutely enormous. It's at least as big as the power set of P1, even in this very simple example. So, you know, sort of bear in mind, never try and talk about the set of all T structures, unless you're giving philosophical introductions to lectures, because it's going to be horrible. So when we talk about stability conditions, a stability condition is a T structure plus some extra data, and that extra data, which have to be compatible in some way, and that compatibility will rule out horrible examples like this. okay. sometimes. Yeah, I mean, another, I should sort of point out one other, I mean, this picture is special in so many ways, but it's still a very useful picture. But one other thing that's special about it is this sort of, I always want to draw these pictures so all the maps go in one direction. And on P1, there's basically only one way of doing that. Right? I mean, you couldn't jumble these things around because everything, you know, it's kind of a connected chain of maps. But you could definitely, I mean, in most categories, you know, there is no kind of preferred ordering system to the category. So when you're slicing things off the side of it, you know, you should think of it as a big lump of cheese or something. You can slice it in all different directions. It's not like it comes with a natural strip to it. I mean, that's actually essentially saying that there's only one stability condition on coherent sheaves on P1, whereas in general there's more.
So in the definition, a shaft, they want to be the full subcategory generated, then for which abelian, or do you want to be abelian from the beginning?
Where's this? In here?
The definition, a shaft, you mean the full subcategory generated by these two, then a shaft?
Yeah, so the situation is this. I start with a triangulated category, and then take a heart of a T-structure. That's automatically abelian. Then I take this torsion pair, and then the claim is that this is now the heart of a T-structure, and therefore it is automatically abelian as well.
I think the question about what objects are in that, generated by
those groups that we had. Yeah. I mean, the best way of saying this is, I mean, you could certainly say it's just the thing, it's just the subcategory of the triangulated category, which the smallest one containing these two things, which is closed under taking cones. Yeah, well, more, I can prove it's the heart of a T-structure, yeah. But, I mean, another way of saying what this is that it's the set of objects such that when you take the filtration corresponding to this T-structure, you get T in one, you get something in T in one place, and you get something in F in the other place, and you get nothing else.
But so these are
the
same as things that was H0,
yeah, and H1, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, yes, exactly, so it's... H1, H minus 1, and H, all other I. Okay? That's another way of defining what that is.
Does every triangulated category have a heart?
No. No. So there... I mean, firstly, the way I defined heart, I meant heart of a bounded T-structure, and that's, you know, some triangulated categories you wouldn't expect to be, you know, even just unbounded. But also, I think, and I'm not really an expert on this, but I think having a T-structure means that your idempotents split, because they split in the abelian category, and somehow everything else is a filtration by those, whereas there are definitely triangulated categories which idempotents don't split in. So...
If I have a heart, then I take the right category. Do I have an equivalence of the wizard?
No. It's a very good question. No, you don't. So that's the kind of something you must say. So the fact that A in D a heart does not imply that D of A is equivalent. So there's several issues about this. Again, I'm not really the expert on this sort of thing. But firstly, this is firstly, there's not even a good map between these things. That's to do with non-uniqueness of cones in triangulated categories, right? Because, I mean, what have you got here? You've got some complex of objects of A, and you'd like to, I mean, each of those objects lives in D, and you'd like to sort of form a repeated sequence of cones, but you can't do that functorially. So there's not even a good functor here. You could kind of solve that problem by using DG categories or something, but then it's still false. Okay, so this is false for a kind of boring reason and a slightly less boring reason. But basically, another way of saying this is that if I have a heart like this, I can think about, and I have two objects in it, I can think of the X groups in the heart. Okay, I compute this in the abelian category. These needn't be the same as these HOMs in D. Okay, so I told you that this is true when you take the heart of the standard T-structure, you know, when A is sitting inside its derived category, but this is not true in general for a heart. And actually what that means is you don't want to think about this at all. Just think about this guy, usually. We'll actually see some example of this later. I think actually, I'm even less of an expert on this, but I think it's true that on the stable homotopy category, there's a heart, that there's a T structure whose heart is abelian groups. So that kind of shows you how far this is from being true. You know, all those Posnikov towers and things, they're giving you filtrations of objects. Into a beam. Right. Yeah. I mean, but that's more of kind of the functoriality problem or something? Or?
No, but not, it's a problem with connectiveness assumption. Uh-huh.
Right. Okay.
So they don't have the structure of the natural thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's try and get onto a slightly. I want to convince you that this has something. What we did is kind of useful. So there's this example of a threefold flop. So the situation. Is as follows. We have so all this works for an arbitrary flop, but let's just assume there's a single curve getting flopped here. So let's call this one something x plus x minus y. Okay, so this is some birational map where there's just some curve which is actually a rational curve. This is a copy of CP1, which you're contracting, and you're contracting it in two different ways. These things are the same outside the curve, but they're different. So I told you already that the derived categories of these things are the same, but you can be more precise than that, and it's useful to be more precise. So what you can do is you can take your coherent sheaves on, let's say, one of these guys. And I need to give you... And basically what I'm going to do is I'm going to do a tilt to something mysterious, which is going to be called per. And here's co-x minus. I'm going to do it... But this... Yeah. Tilt. Right, and those go to the same place. So in other words, I do one tilt, and I get to some strange heart. This is some heart. So I should say that I've already said this, but there is an equivalence between these guys. I have one in mind, and I'm therefore going to identify them with a particular category D. And now I'm going to say that therefore there are two T structures on this category D, one of which is heart is X plus and one of which is heart is X minus, and they're not related by a tilt, they're kind of related by a double tilt. And it's a pretty natural thing you do. You just take the subcategory generated by OC minus 1, OC minus 2, all that stuff. Okay, so you split everything. No, I'm drawing a schematic picture, but I hope you can imagine what you do. You take the subcategory of objects which can be built up out of these by short exact sequences, and then over here you take the stuff with no maps to any of these guys, and I claim that that's a torsion pair. It's not obvious. And here I do almost the same thing, but a tiny difference. I mean, OC minus 1 is the thing in the middle, right? That's the thing in the with no cohomology at all. And the question is whether I put it in or not. So if I don't, then I'll do this. So if I'd written exactly the same thing here and here, you wouldn't have believed me, right? Because somehow I'd do the tilt, and then, I mean, this would have to make these two categories the same. If I tilt by the same thing and end up with the same thing, that would have been too easy. But I didn't. I just did this tiny little difference, and that explains, you know, I mean, that's what the flop is. I mean...
But you could have equally done it the other way, right?
Yeah, it's impossible to distinguish these things, yeah. I mean, that's because the spherical twist, the spherical twist in OC minus 1 does something. Maybe I don't want to say that.
These are both Calabi-Yass?
Sorry. They're Calabi-Yass, definitely. threefold. So in other words, what I'm doing here is I'm just, I mean, the equivalence is a very natural one, actually. You just pull back to a common, let's assume we're in, it's actually generally true. We pull back to a common resolution and we push down again. So it's kind of the most natural equivalence you could kind of think of. And what we're doing is really analyzing a little bit more closely what it does to objects in the abelian categories. We know it doesn't preserve the abelian category, but it nearly does, basically.
So this per has something to do with the common resolution?
Well, you could say it like that, but I mean, actually, a nicer way of saying it's got something to do with this. So, I mean, maybe a couple of remarks on that. So it was actually. So Michel Vandenberg proved that this category per, let's call it something, it's kind of per x, let's just call it per. This proved this category per is equivalent to coherent sheaves over some mildly non-commutative thing living on the base. So A, Y, some sheaf, finite, coherent sheaf of non-commutative algebras. So, it's nothing horrendously abstract, although I've forgotten how you write it down now. I mean, I think in the simplest case where these are -1, -1 curves, this is just it's like generically a 2x2 matrix algebra which degenerates over this point. So, I mean, there is some kind of, it's not a great it's not a huge generation of a commutative situation. It's just mildly non-commutative, and so kind of maybe morally, that's what this category is about. And the other comment I want to make is that this picture has become very useful recently. So Toda and my student John Calabresi use this to answer the question about how are the DT invariants of these two things related. So here by DT invariants, I mean kind of standard curve counting DT invariants. So they give a complete formula for how these things change to understand how DT invariants change of X. You see, so just knowing that there is some derived equivalence between these things is not much use when it comes to questions like that. But if you actually can, you can really describe this thing concretely, then.
And then, we get two hearts, or just they become?
They're the same. I mean.
Oh, they become the same.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose. Yeah, I mean, another way of saying this is that whenever you have a flopping contraction, there are two hearts you can get. Call them per one and per zero. So you can compute these two hearts over here, and you can compute these two hearts over there, and they match up, but they cross, right? So, the two ways of getting this heart. I mean, maybe. Depending on whether I include OC minus one, I get two different hearts. And if I do it on one side of the picture and I do it on the other, then I get the same two hearts, but they're just flipped around, which one corresponds to which. There's another way of saying it. So remember at the start I was sort of trying to talk about we didn't want to be satisfied with just finding random derived equivalences. We actually wanted to find some space such that the different points of the space correspond to different kind of phases of your category, different abelian subcategories or so on. And you see we're getting somewhere here now, because we can say that, okay, so now we can at least think about just all the different T structures on a given category. That's some kind of set, at least. And now we're seeing we've got some kind of notion of closeness on it, because we would like to think of all the different birational models of this threefold as maybe points on that space, but we'd probably like to think of the ones that are related by a single flop as being close together. So you can see this kind of notion of tilting is going to have something to do with the notion of closeness. We would want to consider two abelian categories, or two hearts, to be quite close in this space if they're related by a tilt. Okay, so moving on to some other examples. A very good example of this tilting process is mutation of quivers. And this is exactly corresponds to mutation of quivers. So I want to explain a bit about that now. So I need to say something about quivers with potential. Well, for various reasons, actually. I mean, the basic reason is that we would like to understand categories of coherent sheaves on Calabi L threefolds, but unfortunately we're too stupid to do it. I mean, they're just very, very hard categories of sheaves on threefolds. So we cast around for some other things. So one thing you can do is you can allow your threefold to be non-compact. So it might just be a vector bundle over some lower dimensional thing, what physicists call local Calabi Ls. Or you can just try and understand a piece of a category of a Calabi L threefold. Just take a little piece of it and try and understand that. And that's basically how I would think of quivers with potential. They enable you to just write down small, much smaller categories which have all the same properties as coherent sheaves on Calabi L threefolds. So how do you get one of these? You start with a quiver, which is a directed graph, oriented graph. Something like this. And then W, so that's the quiver, and this is the potential. So we'll see some examples in a minute. But this is a formal sum of cycles in the quiver. Okay. Maybe I should just give one example now, which will be relevant later. Maybe this is the simplest example of all. So let's just choose one with three loops like this. And let's label these at X, Y, and Z. So it's one vertex and three loops. And the potential could be X, Y, Z minus X, Z, Y. Okay, so studying this will turn out to be the same as studying sheaves on C3 somehow, on affine space. So what is this data good for? I mean, there's a whole lecture's worth here, which I really don't want to give. But from this data, what you can cook up is a category D, which we might call D of QW. I'll write its name down, but this is sort of irrelevant. This is called it's the derived category of the complete Ginzburg algebra. Okay, so that's just to say what its name is. What are its properties? So D is what's called a CY3 triangulated category. So the basic point there is that you have these X groups, HOM groups. You have some duality here. Okay, so this is called the CY3 property because it's exactly what holds on the category of coherent sheaves on a Calabi L threefold. On any smooth projective variety, you have a relation like this, Sayre duality. But it's just on a Calabi Yau threefold, it's particularly, when it's Calabi Yau, I mean, normally you would have to tensor by the canonical bundle here, but on a Calabi Yau, that's trivial, so that goes away, and this 3 is telling you you're on a threefold. Okay, so instead of studying these tricky categories of coherent sheaves on Calabi Yau threefolds, we can try and just look at much simpler CY3 triangulated categories. And basically, this gadget is a way of building one of these. So this thing is CY3, and it's generated by a bunch of objects, one for each vertex of your quiver. It's naturally generated by these objects, and you can also say what the X groups are between these objects, or these HOM groups. So what's the best way of saying this? The best way of saying this is what's the straight HOM . So there is the identity map between SI and itself, and there aren't any others. And what are the X1s? That's given by C to the power number of arrows from I to J. Okay, and I claim that all other HOMs equals zero, except those forced by the CY3 condition, which is a kind of an ugly way of saying something. I've told you what the HOM zeros and the HOM ones are. This will therefore tell you what the HOM twos and the HOM threes are, and I'm saying there's no others. So you can see that this quiver is a perfect way of encoding this data. It's got a vertex for each of my objects that's generating the category, and I've got the number of arrows. I mean, there could easily have been two of these arrows. That's telling me the size of the X group between these.
If you just drop this W, would the category be the representations of the quiver?
No. Let me come back to that point in a second. So I want to say something about what's W doing. The point is that there is not a unique category with those properties that I wrote down there, because I haven't told you anything about the composition law, right? A category is certainly it's a bunch of vector spaces, but it also has a composition law, and somehow the potential is encoding the composition law. I want to sort of tread lightly over this point. Basically, the sort of triangulated categories we're interested in are so-called enhanced triangulated categories. It means they're the cohomology of some DG category, and therefore they naturally have higher multiplications. They're A infinity categories. So as well as just kind of studying the composition, in principle you should study higher compositions. And that's what's encoded by this W. So you can imagine why, because, well, maybe you can't yet. So in an A infinity category, you would expect maps like that. Maybe that's MN minus 1. That would be the correct degree. But of course, that would go to HOM 2, because these things are of degree 2 minus N. But now I can think of this thing by the say duality property as HOM 1 SIN, SI1 dual. So we can instead encode this in some kind of cyclically symmetric things which go. Okay, so basically what it's saying is that if I give you a loop, a cycle, can you see I've started off at I1 and I've gone all the way back to I1, I want to give some number. And that's what this potential is encoding. It's telling me what is this higher product when I go around one of these things. So let's not worry too much about the higher product business here. So for instance, in this example, whenever the potential is just cubic, there are no higher products. It's just telling you what the composition law is. And actually, for most of what I'm doing, the potential is not really very important. You need the potential to be able to define a category, but the sort of things I'm talking about, stability conditions, are probably independent of which potential you chose, actually. So that's not too worrying. So what you need to take from this is just that if you give me this data, a quiver with potential, I have got some CY3 triangulated category with which is generated by a particularly simple class of objects, and you can kind of compute with it. So let me give some examples of this. Just to sort of... Yeah, so... So this guy I've just rubbed off. Then if I take my D, then this is equivalent to sheaves on C3 supported at the origin. Okay, so there's an obvious simple object there, which is just the one-dimensional skyscraper sheaf at the origin. And its X1 group with itself is indeed three-dimensional, which is why there are three arrows here. That's just the tangent space. And then this is giving you the product. Here's another example. This example we had in the first lecture. X, Y, Z. So what do we call these? X1. Y1. Z1. X2. And X3. So there's nine arrows in this quiver, and I would take W to be, it's basically the sort of determinant. So this is this alternating tensor that appears in the determinant. And if you do that, you get this local P2. So this is, again, stuff supported on the P2 of the total space of the canonical. Where somehow these vertices correspond to like O, O1, and O2, supported on the. That's the other. I was going to do the conical, but I realised I forgot to write down the potential. So unless Andy knows what the potential is, I think we'll ditch that example. It's a quartic potential. Okay, so the moral of this story is that there are heaps of other examples like this where you have some kind of local, well, I don't know about heaps, but there are quite a lot of examples where there are some local, you know, non-compact Calabi-Yau threefold, which is kind of a vector bundle over a lower dimensional manifold, and you can hope to understand the whole derived, well, a large part of the derived category of that just by contemplating these quivers. Okay, so what does... What does mutation correspond to? What does tilting correspond to? Well, it corresponds to this operation called mutation. Which, again, I don't... I'm hoping you've sort of been exposed to that a little bit before. So what's the statement here? So this is a work of Keller and Yang, which is basically... Right, so... So I take this CY3 category. Maybe I didn't tell you this, but this thing has a canonical T structure. Just like this isn't quite a derived category because it's actually. So I said it was the derived category of the Ginzburg algebra. The Ginzburg algebra is actually a DG algebra. It's not really an ordinary algebra, but because it's negatively graded, this thing still has a T structure. So canonical art. well, A and D, which is actually a finite length category, which means it's simple, with some simple objects, the SI, precisely the SI. Okay, so what we're going to do for our torsion theory is we're just going to take, so this is supposed to be a picture of A, and of course we've got the next bit along, A shifted by 1. So what are we supposed to do? I mean, what's a good torsion theory to take on this category? What we do is we take the torsion bit to just be all direct sums of what our favourite simple. So that means we've chosen a vertex of our quiver, and we take all direct sums like that. And then this bit will actually be modules satisfying, or objects satisfying SI, comma E equals 0. Okay, so that's a way of splitting up this category into two pieces. I mean, why is it a torsion pair? It's just precisely because of this finite length business. I mean, if you give me any object to this category, it has a Jordan-Helder filtration. So I just take all the copies of SI I can off the front of that filtration, and then there won't be any left. So, I mean, you can't do this in any... You know, you can't just take any object in any abelian category and expect to be able to split it up into direct sums of that object and something which is orthogonal. That's not going to happen in general, but it will whenever you have a finite length category like this. And then the result is, so now we can take A sharp, which I guess is something like this. So remember, so we've got T equals and F equals so E in A so E equals 0. And then A sharp, the result is what's the best way of saying this, actually? Yeah. The best way of saying this is that probably the best way is starting on a new problem. The result is that there exists a new quiver with potential, which we call mu I q w. So it's some mutation. This is the so-called mutation. And there's a derived equivalence So that's already a good start. It's saying, hey, we've got this strange operation on quivers such that we get the same derived category when we do it. But there's a more precise thing is true, which is that if we take this canonical heart in here, let's do it this way around. Let's take the canonical heart here, and we pull it back under here. That gives me a new T structure on this. It's not the original one. That would be dumb, because that would be saying the two abelian categories are the same. But it's precisely this tilt. So basically this A sharp corresponds to this under this equivalence. Okay. Here. So I'm not... is the mutation. It's the mutated. So there's all this work of... Anyway, there's a whole industry of people studying mutations of quivers with potential. There is some kind of combinatorial definition, which I'm afraid I don't really want to go into now. I mean, you can easily find it. you know, given a quiver with potential and a vertex on it, there's an operation which will give you a new quiver with potential, and it has the flavour of first invert all the arrows incident with that vertex, then add a new arrow for every pair of arrows passing through that vertex, etc. Right? There's just a sequence of five steps or something you do, and you get a new quiver with potential. I don't want to spend the next 20 minutes doing that. You can look it up. But
there's a video on the grass paper.
That's also true. Yeah. yeah. I mean, here's another example of this tilting operation in action. It gives rise to a kind of a natural operation on quivers with potential. Okay. So just, I mean, yeah, okay, I don't know whether I want to say this. I mean,
Is there a good, I guess maybe you told me that there isn't sort of a, or is there, there's sort of a way of laying, you're going to say that this was like a club, there was a club Yao associate. I wonder if there was a plot, I mean.
I would think of these things as a bit like a flop. I mean, these quivers with mutation, but.
But there isn't like.
Well, I mean, what I was saying yesterday is that given one of these quivers with potential, you could probably, I don't know, I mean, I'm sure this isn't a theorem, but you could probably cook up a geometric, it's called geometric engineering, you could cook up some, maybe, Calabi-Yau threefold and some bunch of objects in that, such that the piece of the derived category generated by those objects is exactly the same as this DQW. Right? So I think physicists kind of would call that geometric engineering. But you know, it's probably not a very relevant it needn't be a relevant piece of geometry. I mean, in these cases, it was a very, you could say that this, you know, if you look at this quiver, well, I can come up with a threefold, it's local P2, and that's a reasonable thing. But for a general, very general quiver, I guess it would just be some crazy thing that you wouldn't be very interested in doing.
Oh, I see.
And then.
You can't flop that guy, so.
Yeah, I mean, there's no, so mutation doesn't correspond to flopping. But in an abstract category theoretic sense, it's a very similar operation in that flopping does correspond to a double tilt and mutation corresponds to a tilt. And actually, whenever you have this thing, I mean, so I told you that in the flopping case, the fact that you understood this tilting led to some result about DT invariance. Well, the same is true here. So there's a very beautiful paper of Kentaro Nagao where he explains... and this idea goes back to Kontsevich and Soberman. But basically, you can understand how the non-commutative DT invariants of this guy and this guy are related. Non-commutative DT invariant is not something very abstract. You're just taking, you're taking moduli spaces of framed representations and taking their Euler numbers. And there's some relation between them, which is actually exactly these cluster transformations. It's the cluster transformations that give you the kind of change of variables in the generating function for the DT invariant. But again, that's proved by really thinking about this tilting picture. Okay, so I want to do another example, which is very, very relevant. I want to introduce a category which is going to come up again later when we're talking about stability conditions. It gives a really nice example, and it's related to Riemann surfaces and triangulations of them. So we fix some number G and D. When we take some surface, this defines a topological surface, SGD. So it's got genus G. And D marked points. Let's call them P1, P2. It's very important that there is at least one marked point for us. And also, we want to be in the hyperbolic case. The easiest way for me to say this at the minute is just say, assume. So there's going to be a number which is going to be important here. And I want to assume that this is at least like that. Okay, so it basically means that if the genus is zero, there must be at least three marked points. how do we get a category out of this chap? So we consider ideal triangulations. So the ideal means that the vertices of the triangulation are the points. The set of vertices is the set Pi. Okay. So here's some... let's draw a reasonable amount of this. Right. So now you can define a quiver with potential. And you do it like this. So you take the vertices of your quiver. It's slightly confusing. The vertices of your quiver are the midpoints of the edges of your triangulation. I did way too many. And then to get the quiver, you draw this. You draw a little arrow inside each triangle. A little inscribed triangle inside each triangle. Okay, it's kind of a weird thing to do. I'll explain in a minute why it's the right thing to do. What went wrong? Right, that one went that way. Oh, that one went the wrong way. Yeah, these should be. Okay, so it's a big mess. But the point is that, so there's your quiver, Q, and what's the potential? So the potential, which as I say is not sort of vitally important for what I'm talking about, is like that, minus so in other words, there's two obvious systems of cycles here. There's the cycles I put in myself, those triangles. And then if you notice the way I did it, I mean, hopefully if I did it right, there's a cycle around each of the old vertices of my quiver. Okay. Now, I should say I've sort of hidden something from you here, because... the first thing to say is that any two triangulations are related by a chain of flips. So this is this operation. Okay, where you take two triangles that are joining each other and do that to them. But a kind of warning, what you really need to, you need to allow degenerate triangles, unfortunately. This is kind of a big headache. So you need to allow that, but even worse, you need to allow this. These are called self-folded triangles. And actually, this rule I gave you is not correct unless... I mean, it's correct if there are none of these triangles. So you can take your nicest triangulation, then that's absolutely fine. That's the right rule. But in the presence of these self-folded triangles, the rule becomes quite complicated. And this was all dealt with by Daniel Labadini-Fragoso. So he defined the right potential, and he proved the following nice result, which is that mutation of quivers... So mutation at vertex I. So remember the vertices of my quiver corresponds to the edges of my triangulation. So I can label it by an edge E, and that corresponds to this flipping edge E.
This
is just two triangles which share two edges. I mean, the point is that once you flip, if you now flip this, you're going to get this. I mean, this is the first sign that things are going wrong, and then this is really a bit unpleasant. I mean, you can also see, for example, if I have this, I have a two cycle in my quiver. And we don't usually like potentials with degree two terms. Okay, so the point is that if you change the triangulation like this, you're going to get a different quiver, but it's actually precisely related by a mutation. But now there's an obvious observation, which is that DQW is actually independent of the triangulation. Because we said that any two triangulations are related by a chain of these flips. Flips correspond to mutations, and we have this theorem that whenever you do a mutation, you've got the same derived category. So we can call it DGD. Okay. So this is a very nice example because, so, you know, again, kind of my mantra is that you shouldn't think about derived equivalences, fix your category and think about T-structures. So now what we can say, roughly, is some kind of, as I say, you should never consider the set of all T-structures, but say some, well, some nice T-structures on B correspond to triangulations of this surface SGD. So that's kind of a bit of a strange thing, but it gives you a feel for what these you know, what these kind of classes of nice T structures might look like. They're very combinatorial things. They're kind of corresponding to triangulations in this case. and as we say, we want to and I should modify this because it's not quite true as stated. And the reason is, so how would we go about trying to prove this? I mean, how would we make such a correspondence? Well, we've fixed, I mean, DGD, we're just kind of defining this to be the quiver with potential corresponding to some triangulation, some fixed triangulation. And then if we have another triangulation, we're wanting to kind of pull back by this equivalence and say we've got a new T-structure. But that equivalence needn't have been unique, right? I mean, I said any two triangulations were related by flips, but there was no kind of God-given sequence of ways of getting from one flip to another. And actually, the groupoid given by flipping was studied by Fock and Goncharov, and it actually gives you the mapping class group of the surface. So the correct way of saying this is that if you take triangulations of your surface and mod out by the mapping class group, then over here, this corresponds to there's a distinguished subgroup of the group of autoequivalences. I mean, it's not so important. And that distinguished subgroup is gotten by taking Keller and Yang's equivalence, you know, going around a loop of triangulations and getting back where you started and taking the composition of Keller-Yang's equivalences, and the subgroup that generates is this thing. So I basically.
And how can you say? And here there is this threefold picture.
So in this case, yeah. So I should remark so that in joint work with Ivan Smith, which Ivan has done all of, so let's just say it's Ivan Smith. this category DGD, or at least can be embedded in the Fakaya category of some. Some variety, well, some symplectic manifold. Symplectic manifold. So this is a symplectic manifold. Symplectic. Six dimensional manifold. I mean, you really need a result like this. I mean, it begs the question. You know, what was all this crazy combinatorics about? This is a very bizarre way to define a category. Just define it by some completely ridiculous quiver, and then say, it doesn't actually matter which. You know, there is this kind of invariance property. what's the geometric meaning? And this is a good answer to this question. I hope Tim's not going to ask me too many questions about... Simon's... Tim. I hope you're not going to ask me too many questions about the Fakaya category side of this story. But I can tell you what this threefold is if anyone asks. So that's the only kind of geometric interpretation I can give of this. I don't know what the... how you would interpret this via coherent sheaves, but I guess probably it can, you know, I guess it's the mirror of that, which probably can be computed.
This is something like a toric mirror, or is this, this guy's not toric?
This guy's, no, I don't think so. It's an affine, YGD is some affine quadric vibration over, over your surface. Okay, so it's one of these typical things. It's some kind of trivial vibration away from.
I was actually thinking, I was wondering, but it, But if I vary the surface, I mean, your thing here doesn't use the complex structure of the surface.
Right, right.
So wouldn't that threefold be different?
Yeah, so that's what I'm sort of shying away from saying. So let me just say it. So we want to... So to define this threefold, the best way of writing it is as a projective, you know, as a quasi-projective variety. But remember, that's giving you more than you want, because that's giving you a complex structure on it as well. Okay, but hey, so to define it as a complex variety, you actually need to choose a quadratic differential on your surface with poles at those points and zero, and some bunch of zeros. And the point is that there are a lot of moduli there, because you can change the complex structure on this and you can change your quadratic differential, but it doesn't change this as a symplectic manifold. So, but it's kind of this, I find this a very peculiar situation. It's kind of impossible to write this thing down without making that choice, but then you have to show that the choice doesn't, well, I think this is kind of standard, that the choice of all that, all those choices are not going to affect the symplectic structure. So that kind of fits in with the next part of the story, and that I wanted to, so which we'll come to next time, is that we want to make a continuous version of this set. So now at least we have some kind of set of nice T-structures which are corresponding to triangulations on this surface. We want to make a continuous version of that. So the theorem will say stability conditions on this category modulo this same group is equal to quadratic differentials on this surface. So a continuous, and I'll explain why. I mean, a quadratic differential can be thought of as a continuous version of a triangulation, in that the triangulations parameterize a cell decomposition of quadratic differentials, and in the same way, stability conditions are giving you a continuous version of T-structures in exactly the same way. A T-structure gives you a cell, you know, there are cells in the space of stability conditions indexed by T-structures. So this is just a very nice example to think about, because it kind of makes contact with things people care about. So next on Tuesday I will start talking about stability conditions and do this example, and so there'll be a bit of geometry of quadratic differentials will crop up there, and then I guess the stuff about DT invariance and the wall crossing formula will come in the last lecture on this. Okay, thank you. That's very generous of you.
So you've emphasized sort of three-dimensional collabios. I mean, is that because you're somehow foreshadowing their special role in Donaldson-Thomas theory, or just for example, or is that the reason?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I mean, basically because certainly... So firstly, collabiao, there's a kind of a mysterious thing going on that if you try and do these computations on a non-collabiao, you get kind of arbitrarily horrible answers. I mean, you know, you can kind of do them, but there is just some... I mean, I guess it comes down to the fact that collabials have a lot of symmetry, and that helps you organize your computations. I mean, this notion of tilting goes back a long way to the... I mean, the term was coined by Brenner and Butler, who were some algebraists working in the late 70s. And they have this amazing paper where they introduce it, this concept. It's very nice. And at the back, they have a whole bunch of computations, which are, you know, just sort of pen and ink computations. And they compute the mutations of a bunch of quivers, but without this CY3 condition. And you just get, I mean, you could say garbage, but I don't think of it as garbage. It's just amazing that people could have computed all this stuff. But you just get a whole bunch of very strange-looking quivers, all related. So the CY3 condition, you know... The collabial condition seems to kind of bring more order to things and make the computations easier. And then dimension-wise, I mean, kind of CY1 you can do. CY2, there's a whole story about stability conditions on K3s, and you can, I mean, that's something you could, you know, it's a very nice picture. But CY3 is somehow the frontier of our knowledge. I mean, that's what, you know, that's the thing we'd really like to understand, but we don't understand very well.
But to encode the whole derived category in just one function, you need CY3, right? I mean, to have it just this function W.
Yes, that's certainly very true, yeah. I mean, this quiver with potential business. Well, actually, yeah. I mean, there is a version of this story for any CYD, I think. But, yeah, I mean, basically the quiver with potential was a very much a CY3 phenomenon there. Yeah, I think that's about all I can say.
Any other questions? Okay, let's thank Tom again. Mm-hmm.